right. One of the things about the Bible that increases my faith just in the surface reading of it is the fact that we can go back to a man like Job, whom I think lived in the patriarchal age. I think that's what we're meant to understand here. Maybe a contemporary of Abraham, we could say, someone like that. And I read Job and watch the conversations that go back and forth, and I think of the people that in my journey through life I have met who have been in the furnace of affliction, as someone called it, and it's the same conversations that I'm familiar with in the lives of people that I've known, and sometimes in my own life. And I think what I see here is so much like us that it has to say something about human nature and about our walk with God. If I were to let that line represent what we would call level ground, if that is an even keel, if we would call it, if that's what life is usually like, then when we start the conversation here in Job, if this is as bad as low as you can get, and if this is as high as you can get, where would you place Job when we start in chapter 3? I'd say about right here. I mean, he's wishing he never had been born. And as the conversation goes along here, what I observe is here Job begins at least to express himself, and then his friends answer, and Job gets a little more vocal, maybe in response to what they've had to say, and expresses his hunger and his desire for God. It goes along like that. It goes along like that. And then there's some high points here where he talks about his confidence in God. And if you remember, we found one in Job 13. We found one in Job 15. We found one in Job 19. There's still these swings like this. But overall, Job is becoming more and more himself. He's coping. His attention is being turned away a little bit more with each step from his battle, if I can call it, with his friends for his integrity, a little more and more toward God. And when we begin today in Job 23, I think you get a picture of what I'm talking about here. I'd like to call your attention to Job 23, verses 8 through 12 to start with. Job 23, 8 through 12. And what he's doing here, if you remember, he's answering the third speech of Eliphaz, which has been pretty much God deals with wicked men. You need to agree with God and get rid of your wickedness so that good can come to you. And Job's responding to that, and he said, verse 3, if I knew where I might find him, I'd come to his seat, I'd lay my case before him and all of that. But here's where he is now, verses 8 through 10. Brenda, let me ask you to read for us, if you don't mind, and we'll look at this little paragraph for a second.
Thank you, Jim.
Yes.
Behold, I go forward, but he is not there. Backward, but I cannot perceive him. When he acts on the left, I cannot behold him. When he turns on the right, I cannot see him. But he knows the way I take.
All right, now I want everybody to notice carefully the but in verse 10. This is an important part of this book right here. Brennan, go ahead. Verse 10, start over at 10.
But he knows the way I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold.
Go ahead, 11 and 12.
My foot has held fast to his path, and I have kept his way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the command of his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food.
All right, now, look at where he is here in this. He is, does he Does he recognize exactly where God's presence is? Does he feel like that he has now found God and he has come into God's presence and he's able to lay his case before him? Is that? No, that's not where he is. He feels like that whichever way he turns, he still is in confusion about where God is. But what is the conviction in verse 10? There are two convictions there that are really important, the faith accomplishments in Job's journey.
Job may not be seeing God, but God sees him.
All right. There's the first thing. Job may not, that's a wonderful way to say it. Job may not be seeing God, but he is convinced, even now at this point, that God sees him. Why is that so important? All right, it's the idea that he still, remember, this is what Satan has challenged to start with, that God really is not, man really is not paying any attention to God, and God's really not paying any attention to man. It's sort of a mercenary type agreement, so forth. If you'll scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. That's the level that Satan says God and man have to operate on. Job, however, now at this point is still holding to the conviction that even if he is in this terrible mess, and even if it doesn't look like things are working like they should, and that God is blessing him like he needs to be blessed, he still thinks God is watching. Now, I want to point out to you how important this conviction is in Scripture. If you'll come over to 1 Peter 3 for just a second. In 1 Peter 3, and by the way, 1 Peter, you may know, is written to Christians who are suffering not because of their wickedness, but because of their faith. Y'all remember that's the context of this book. And one of the things that Peter does in 1 Peter 3 is to quote from Psalm 34. In other words, this is a conviction, both Old Testament and New, about God's providence in his world. I'd like you to take note, we can read verses 10 through 12 here, you can see. Linda, if you have it, would you read that quote, 1 Peter 3, 10 through 12.
For whoever would love life and see good days and keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech, then he must turn from evil and do good, but he must keep and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil.
All right, now how does the first part of verse 12 there relate to Job's statement in Job 23 and 10. What is the key conviction that people have to have in order to survive suffering? That God is paying attention, that the eyes of the Lord are on them and his ears are open to their prayers. All right, now that's the first thing with Job. Now, what's the other part of this now in Job 23:10 again, back over there. What's the second part of what Job says that's really important? The first one is, God knows the way that I take. And the second one is,
even if he doesn't, he's still a father.
All right, that's a part of it. That's a part. But in this verse, take a look at verse 10.
When he tests me.
All right. Now, when he tests me, notice, gives purpose to suffering. What it does is, this is not punishment for any wickedness in my life. It is not purposeless hurting. Job is looking at it now as when he has tried me. Now, Job has it, I want you to see this, he has it half right. What he's going through is trial. Unfortunately, who's trying him? Satan is. God is allowing it in his providence. God knows, all right. But he's trying. Now, Job's determination is, when he's tried me, I'm going to come forth as gold. What's the picture that Job is using in that illustration? or I'd like ore being purified in the smelting process, and here it's all melted down, and then the impurities are skimmed off, and what's left is pure gold. Can suffering have that kind of an effect in human experience? I think it can. Can you look back in your own life and remember circumstances, even if they were not so drastic as Job's, where by coming through that with God, you came out a person closer to Him and stronger? I'm not going to ask you to explain it, but can you think of that kind of a time in your own life? I think a lot of us probably can. Now look at, why does Job think this? Well, verse 11 and 12, he still has held fast to his steps. He's kept God's way. He's not departed from what God said. He keeps treasuring up the commandments in his way. Now, I want to just point out a little bit of the fact, what I'm getting at here, that Job has come a ways in saying this. Look back at Job chapter 9 with me for a second. In Job chapter 9, Job was replying again to one of his friends who advised him to turn to God because God wouldn't reject a blameless man. And look at what Job says in the I'm going to resist the temptation to reread a lot of this chapter. So just look with me at verse 14. And verse 14 through 16, 14 through 17, maybe. Job is talking about the possibility of coming to God like they have said. How then can I answer him? How then can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I'm in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies me without cause. He won't let me get my breath, but he fills me with bitterness. If it's a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it's a matter of justice, who can summon him? You see why I'm saying that Job has made some progress in working through this now? With this conversation with his friends and through all the mood swings here, he is overcoming, to use the New Testament word from Revelation. He is overcoming. How? By enduring it. I wish there were an easy way to overcome, but there's not. And Job is overcoming here. Now, he still, I'd like you to notice, back to Job 23 again, notice that while Job thinks that God is unchangeable, that's the version that I have here with a difficult word in verse 13, he still thinks that his pleadings are not changing God's mind about what God is letting happen. He desires what he does. He'll complete what he appoints to him. In other words, I'm going to have to come through this because God's not going to just take it away. He says in verse 15, therefore I'm terrified of his presence. And here's what I mean by the mood swings. In verse 8 and 9, as I understand it, he's looking for God's presence. But in verse 15 and 16, how does he feel about God's presence? He dreads it. So you look at the ambivalence that's there. When you're in this situation, you know you're longing and hungering for something, but you're not sure what it is. I want to use an illustration. Brian and I just did a camp session a month ago now, Brian, I still feel the effects of it. While we were there, one of the young men who has been one of our campers a few years back and was there to help us did one of the devotionals. And what he said struck me. He said that the week before he came to camp that year, his high school basketball coach, Brian? His high school basketball coach, who was only 33 and who had two little ones and who was a very important person in his life, just fell over and died. And he talked about how that struck him. He just couldn't believe it. He couldn't understand it. Well, then he got to camp, and our series, our theme that year, based on the Lord's model prayer in Matthew 6, was, "May I call you Father." And he talked to us about how he felt about that. He did not want to call God Father. He was angry at God because of what had happened. And he told the story of how things went for him that week until finally toward the end of the week, he just completely broke down in telling some of the other young men in his cabin about what had happened. Just completely broke down. And he told us about how he worked through that situation. I think that's something about Job wants to call God Father. He wants to be in God's presence, but he's not sure he wants to be in God's presence. And again, have any of you present here ever found yourself in that situation in your life? That's a part of faith. That's what I'm getting at here. Do not let that make you feel like faith is a hopeless goal for you somewhere or another. That's a part of the journey. And you can see it maybe with Job here. I hope you think about it. All right, any observation? Look at verse 17. "Yet I'm not silenced because of the darkness," he says. I'm terrified in his presence. My heart's faint, verse 16. "But I'm not silenced because of the darkness." I think that is a triumphant statement of faith right there. It doesn't mean it's easy for him now. He's in the darkness, but he's not silenced by it. All right, any observation you have about this, Ruth?
Well, I'm just thinking, maybe I'm just recent faith, but I have those feelings a lot of, yes, I want to go to heaven, I want to be there, I want to see God, but it scares me to death.
Yeah, yeah. In Job's case, that feeling is there because of the pain and suffering that he is enduring in his own life. I know a little bit about you and Gene's care for family members and so forth. You've been around that kind of thing in their lives, and you've seen that kind of thing. A lot of us who have a view of the holiness of God, which means that which we've measured on the idea the righteous will scarcely be saved and the judgment starts at their house, and what will it be like for the rest of us? And so we feel like what you've just described, if you mixed in the pain and agony that we see and think of God's sovereignty in that way and then major in that idea. You and I, however, have to grow in this process of looking at God through Christ and seeing Him as Father and coming to the place in Romans 8 where we cry, "Abba, Father," just as Jesus did in the garden. So it is part of the when Paul said fight the good fight of faith, he didn't just mean arguing with critics of Christianity. He meant this part of it as well, I think. Norma?
It's kind of reverse what you're saying. I don't know if that's what I was going to say. But it seemed like from the time he passed away and I came into you, I wanted God in my life.
All right.
I just didn't know how to go about doing it.
All right, that's an important observation. There is the other side of the coin where the kind of things that you've seen people go through awaken in our hearts our need for God and cry for Him. And that's a very helpful observation, I think. Anybody else? All right, I'll turn our attention to chapter 24 now. Job goes a step farther, and I want you to think again of this, of these mountains and valleys that are here, because in chapter 24 again, Job turns back to the questions that his friends have planted in his mind and his heart. And remember, the theme of this book is Job struggles because of Satan's trials that he's putting him through, and then the seeds of doubt that Job struggles with, Satan has used his friends to plant them in his mind. They have said, God rules the world so that when and if anybody does anything wicked, then God requires it of them. And remember, Job has said, but I've seen a lot of wicked people who seem to be fat, sleek, and happy. That's my words, not his words, but that's what he's saying. And in chapter 24, that comes. I want to just, to save time, I'd like to read part of this for us, and you kind of follow along. What he's puzzled over here now. Notice how this rises above just his own hurt. What he's puzzled with at this point is with the nature of God's rule in his world. What Job can't see is why God lets it happen like it does. Verse 1, why are not times of judgment kept by the Almighty? And why do those who know him never see his days? In other words, why do we not see? Why does God not make it more obvious that he is vindicating faith in him by judging the enemies of his cause? When a professor stands before a class and says, all right, God, if you're really there, strike me down with a thunderbolt right now. Why doesn't God at least one time do it? You know? Would you feel better about the times of the Almighty here if the next time, or at least one time, when some entertainment personality belittled and made fun of the idea of Christ with some jeer or sneer, if the entire broadcast system just went black right then, wouldn't that make you feel good? I think that's what Job is saying here. Do you ever wonder about that? Honestly. Why does God let them get away with it?
Well, I don't know though. He have, I mean, it had happened to Job time, but God has the Pharaoh.
That's right. That's right.
And people still.
But when you're hurting, yes, do you remember all that? Yeah. Eddie?
Something along that line. I was visiting with a Catholic person several years ago, and we were discussing, of course, the Bible. And the Pope came up, and I made a statement that your Pope is just a man like the rest of us. Just telling you. You
know,
like, you
ever got strapped? All right. He thought that maybe that was the end of it for you.
Yeah.
Well, one of the puzzles, and by the way, this is a puzzle I don't mean to make light of, but the nature of the sovereignty of God is always one of the most difficult issues of theology. How can you say God is all powerful and God is good, and still face up to the hurt and loss that you see in His world. That always has been one of the puzzles. The book of Habakkuk is about that. That's exactly what it's about. Jeremiah in his worst hours, that's what he struggled with. And a lot of us understand that. Now, Job gives us some examples of what he means by this. Verse 2, removing landmarks and seizing flocks and pastures. In other words, why does he let robbery, theft, why does he let people get away with it? Verse 3, they take away from the fatherless and the widow. The poor are taken advantage of in verse 4. Their children are taken advantage of in verse 5. Their goods, their crops, their fields, and all of that are taken away in verse 6. Their clothing and housing are taken away in verses 7 and 8. People live naked and hungry, verse 10. The dying groan, the wounded calls for help. And look at the crushing statement at the end of verse 12. What does Job say? All right. From out of the city, the dying groan, the soul of the wounded cries for help, yet God charges no one with wrong. What is it that Job is puzzled with there? What's bothering him?
It's not their evil that's caused it. It's just the way the life is.
All right.
All right.
All right. The apparent inactivity of God in these social circumstances that Job has just recited for us. In verse 13 and following, he goes a little bit farther about those who rebel against the light. And by the way, in this paragraph, there's a play on the words with either the word light or some form of it. You want to read the paragraph that way. Let me do that. There are those who rebel against the light, who are not acquainted with its ways and do not stay in its path. Remember, we're called to walk in the light. There are people who don't. The murderer rises up before it is light. When is the hour of the evildoer? It's darkness, and that he may kill the poor and needy and the thief. And in the night he's like a thief. The eye of the adulterer also waits for the twilight, saying, "No one will see me," and he veils his face. In the dark they dig through houses. By day they shut themselves up. They do not know the light, for deep darkness is mourning to all of them, for they are friends with the terrors of deep darkness. And I want you to back up to chapter 23 and verse 17 and notice what Job has said. Yet I am not silenced because of the what? Darkness. Nor because thick darkness covers my face. And now what he's talking about is the things that are done in thick darkness by enemies of God who seem to get away with it. Now in verses 18 and following, Job relates all of this to what his friends have said about how God deals with these things. And I want you to see that his friends have now, that what's being illustrated here is his friends have offered platitudes about how things work. Job, however, is thinking on a deeper level about reality. And if you can think of it this way, the platitudes are just the shallow explanations that seem to comfort the person who doesn't have much at stake in the fight. Reality, however, is the struggle that a man who is in the middle of this goes through as he tries to not only cope with physical hurt, but also with the mental anguish that goes with it. And the mental anguish is at this point with Job the more severe part of his agony, and you can see that. Now, any comment about what Job has said in chapter 24? It's the part of this where if God rules, why are they getting away with it? If I dread his presence, like Bruce said a while ago, why do people who don't even think he's present seem to succeed in getting away with it? That's part of freedom.
You know, God did strike on everyone that did something wrong before, just fall out of fear.
Yeah.
And take away the heavy will part.
That's right. And the population would shrink dramatically, wouldn't it? Yeah. That's right. But Brendan's point is deeper than that. That really is what this book is about, isn't it? If people just operated in their relationship with God based on their fear of being struck down, would anyone ever relate to him as a father and think of themselves as his children? No, he'd be a tyrant. And when pagan gods or goddesses, if you go back and read mythology or you think about idolatry, what is always the view of those gods and goddesses and people's service to them? All right, if anything bad happens, it's because I made them mad, and so now I have got to pacify that deity so that he won't be mad at me anymore. That's very much never relationship, because the God is never really seen as a being you could relate to, and this God is, and that's what has Job puzzled at this time. All right, Ruth.
Even if it wasn't his fault, if he was doing what we are supposed to do, and God prospers us like he had Job begin with, mm-hmm. and then when he did something bad, he took it away, we'd soon figure out, you know, if he did it pretty regularly, he wouldn't be able to do that. It'd be kind of like training his dog, you know.
All right. Maybe that's a treat, huh? You really want to be the kind of creature who can only respond to a treat. I mean, you might be thinking, that wouldn't be such a bad life. I don't know. But you think about that. We are persons, and that's the part of this picture. All right. I wanted to just call your attention to 25 so you can think about Job's answer. 25, the second of Job's friends gives his third speech. And one of the things about platitudes is that after a while they become repetitions. And his friends don't really have anything new to say this time. Bildad's point, he is saying that dominion and fear are with God. And if you notice 24 in verse 1, that is exactly the thing that Job cannot figure out. Bildad's claim is, verse 4, how then can man be in the right before God? Who can be born of woman? How can he who is born of woman be pure, he is saying. Verse 6 is a key statement about how Bildad. If you look at the comparison that Bildad makes to humanity in verse 6, what is it? You talk about a low view of man. Let me read you the ESV on this one. How much less man who is a maggot, and the son of man who is a worm? Is in that view, Bildad's view of mankind, more like God's or Satan's? All right, it is more like Satan's. But God looked at things and said, have you considered my servant? And Satan looks at things and says, not a one of them is anything more than a worm. I mean, that's pretty much what he's saying. We have to be careful in our dealing with our sinfulness to realize that the problem is sin and not personhood. There are some of our songs that, and I know they're poetic, that speak of, you know, like one of my favorite songs has the phrase "in such a worm as I." I understand what it's saying poetically, but in reality, the tragedy of sin is that it ruins something so valuable, and that is a person made in God's image. Bildad's word is just that. Now, I want to, one thing before we let you go. Did the second bell ring? Brother Feeney's not here to tell me that the bell rung. Did it already ring? Did it? I want to just point out to you, in your reading for next week, please make a note for yourself that in chapter 27, at verse 13, it may be that right at that point and for the rest of this chapter, the third one of Job's friends makes his third speech. This paragraph is too much unlike some of the things that Job has said and too much like his friends to be taken real easily. So even though he's not named, it may be that Zophar speaks at verse 13. Please work your way at least through 28 for next week. Thank you for being with us today.